recording has started. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Richard. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the IGO-INGO Curative Rights Protection PDP Working Group call on the 1st of April 2015. On the call today, we have George Kirkus, Peter Reinforth, Val Sherman, David Maher, Mason Cole, and Phil Corwin. We received no apologies for today's call. And from staff, we have Mary Wong, Steve Chan, Amy Bivins, Yolanda Jimenez, and myself, Naku Peregrine. I'd like to remind you all to please state your names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you ever so much, and over to you, Peter.
Thank you, Peter here. Are there any statements of interest updates? I see no hands raised. Okay, so let's proceed directly to the first main point, update on engagement with GAC and IGOs. And, for the IGOs, we have prepared seven specific questions based also on our work so far. I see nothing on the... But you got it also by email, so I hope you will have the possibility to look at it. I can just quickly go through the specific questions. The first one is, how do IGOs handle standard contract clauses on jurisdiction and choice of law in mass market and other standard form contracts? For instance, when licensing software or entering into standard arrangements for the provision of goods and services. Is it standard practice to replace these with an arbitration clause? And if so, what form would such a clause usually take? That is also to get specific input on how they normally deal with contracts. And question two, when IGOs register their own second-level domain names, how do they handle standard clauses in domain name registration agreements covering the binding nature of the UDRP as an ICANN consensus policy, governing jurisdiction and choice of law? Number three, when IGOs are deciding whether or not to file a complaint in a UDRP proceeding, is it relevant if the mutual jurisdiction specified is that one of the registrar concerned or of the registrant respondent? And now I also see the document online. Good. And question four, as the working group charter tasks us with gathering data and research on the topic, we would appreciate if IGOs can provide specific recent examples demonstrating the extent of cyber squatting in respect of their acronyms. In addition, what is the scope of the problem in the GTLD space as compared to CCTLDs? How do IGOs deal with these issues of standing and sovereign immunity in dispute resolution proceedings involving CCTLDs, where the relevant policy also includes a mutual jurisdiction or similar clause? Question number five, in view of the jurisdictional concerns, what are the forms of legal action that IGOs are likely to pursue when they believe their rights, including those beyond the domain name system or trademark law, are infringed? For example, are there intergovernmental, national, other legal or judicial mechanisms that IGOs can use that do not involve a waiver of immunity? And what would be the difficulties, if any, with a mechanism by which an IGO member state acts on the IGO's behalf? What if the mutual jurisdiction requirement specifies that to apply to IGOs, it has to be a jurisdiction of one of its member states? Alternatively, would a provision that expressly limited IGO's submission to jurisdiction only to that specific dispute involving that specific domain name and registrant alleviate IGO's concerns? Question six, since the adoption of the UDRP, has an IGO on the GAC list pursued legal action in a national court against an alleged cyber squatter or trademark infringer? Besides juridical and other remedies at law, what other means do IGOs use to pursue cyber squatters? such as contact the register in question, web hosting companies, or payment processors. Question number 7. A major concern with removing the mutual jurisdiction requirement is that this would raise due process issues and prejudice an individual's right of access to courts, such as if the role of the court were replaced by a binding private arbitral appeal. It could also change the nature of the UDRP from an optional supplement to juridical determination under national laws to a preemptive procedure. What substantive or procedural safeguards can be put into place that can adequately replace the diminution of such a right and assure due process? And what we have tried to do here is to not just send out general questions, but actually specify them as much as possible so that we can hopefully also get more specified replies to our questions. And we have creating this questionnaire together with the staff based on what we have discussed within the working group and also what we have figured out when it comes to IGO's disputes that have already been settled using the UDRP. So that's a document that I hope you can approve and that we therefore can send out to the IGO small group. And I open the floor. Yes, George. George, please.
Can you hear me?
No, I can hear you, yes.
Oh, thanks. Sorry, I must have been muted. George Kriegel speaking. I just want to say that it looks like a very good letter, and thanks for incorporating in the footnotes some of the additional comments about things like the .de and .ru lack of any ADR procedures, which requires the complainants to go to the courts in all cases. So I think that might be informative. There was actually a video of ICANN President Fadi Chahadi presenting to the DNA Association trade group at one of the recent ICANN meetings, where he was talking about how many of the European regulators who are trying to impose various new requirements on UGTLDs, it was pointed out to them that they were trying to impose rules that didn't exist in their own CCTLDs, like the .eu. For example, when people were trying to get restrictions on casinos certain professions, they were saying, what would the procedure be in the .eu? And they said there's no such procedure. So that kind of goes to the same idea for the IGOs, that these special rules don't even exist in the CCTLDs. So thanks for incorporating that into the footnotes.
Thanks, George, for the comments. And also, yes, thank you for the additional information you sent out that were very useful to incorporate when we prepared for this. So I'm not sure, Mary, did you have any additional suggestions to this or comments?
Hi, everybody. This is Mary, and thank you, George, again. Thanks, Petter. No, not from the staff side. Our suggestion would be to have you and Phil, and of course we'll facilitate that, send that off as soon as possible, because there are a lot of questions here, some quite substantive, and so we want to move ahead of our work. The sooner we send it, hopefully, the sooner we'll get a response.
Good, thanks. George, I see your hand up. I don't know if it's Still up or no? Okay, thanks. When it comes to GAC, Mason, what is the status there?
Mason speaking. Well, I think everybody knows the status. There's been, you know, the questions have been posed. So far, we've been unsuccessful in getting a GAC response. I sent a new note to the GAC and the GAC Secretariat. I believe it was Friday of last week, or perhaps Monday of this week. I don't recall. Asking again for GAC input. I'll follow that up with a phone call if necessary, but I'm afraid we haven't been very successful in getting direct input from the GAC.
Okay, thanks. Steve?
Thanks, Petter. This is Steve from staff. I just wanted to mention that in speaking with some of our GAC support colleagues, as far as I know, they're actually circulating a draft of the responses amongst the GAC leadership. So without speaking to the timing in which they're going to be able to return those responses, I know they at least have drafts that they're circulating and deliberating over. So I can't say exactly when it's going to be delivered to us, but it's at least in process. Thanks.
Thanks. Phil?
Now I'm off mute. Phil here. Just want to thank Mason for his continuing efforts on this. Mason, do you perceive that this is just the continuing problem we have with the, we being everyone involved with ICANN, with the GAC catching up with the process, or is it, do you perceive any particular something to do with this specific issue where a are unhappy with our work, or just their basic issues with staying current on working group progress and indicating any kind of consensus or providing feedback?
Petter, if I may?
Yeah, please.
The question, Phil, Mason again. I think it's both. I think the GAC is still acclimating itself to finding a way to collaborate with the GNSO and all of its processes. And in addition to that, I think the subject of the questions is thorny enough for the GAC to need to take time to reply. You know, I'll remind the working group, as they reminded me, that the GAC indicated that we would have an answer, we, the working group, would have an answer of some kind following the Singapore meeting. So I'm encouraged to hear Steve say that there's a draft circulating within the GAC. I was unaware of that. I admit to some frustration that in my role as liaison, I'm not getting the feedback directly from the GAC that I would like, but I'm still hoping to improve that. But I think in answer to your question, Phil, I think the answer is both. I hope that's somewhat helpful in terms of shedding light on this.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Steve. Do you want to add something? No. Okay. Then it seems that we're ready with this topic and... Yeah, I have a George question here. Will the GAC perhaps wait until after the next ICANN meeting face-to-face before responding? Yeah, I presume so. On the other hand, that's the common reply, that they need another meeting in order to respond. So I do hope that we can at least get some kind of inputs. And as we said at the meeting last time, also to the possibility to reach out to the this smaller group within that actually dealing with these questions. Okay. Point number three, update on proposed amendments to the Working Group Charter by GNSO Council. Here I note that if we're going to decide on something to send out to the Council, I just saw that the document, the motion deadline, is on Monday. So we'll see if we can have anything clear to be sent out before the deadline. Next council meeting is on April 16. I'll leave it over to Phil.
Okay. And all right. This is the. Everyone, hear me? Okay.
Yep.
Okay. This is the draft motion to amend the charter. This has not been forwarded to the GNSO Council yet. I forget what the deadline is. I just got an email on that. But we have several. Mary, do you know what? I know we just got an email this morning on the deadline for submission.
April 6th.
April 6th, yeah. So we have 5 days to perfect this, to get this considered at the next council meeting. So it's pretty simple, whereas number one just restates. I'm getting an echo in the background. If somebody has a speaker on, could you shut it or put your phone on mute? Thanks. So the whereas is just a recitation of the factual background. With some very minor technical amendments. Really the resolve clause is the critical one, and it would, let me take you through the words because it changes the mission and scope statement. It would amend it. The original one for purpose of this PDP, the scope of IGO and INGO identifiers are to be limited to those identifiers previously listed by the GNSO's PDP, Working Group on the Protection of International Organization Identifiers, and all GTLDs. I think we need an acronym for that, don't we? Returning the text as protected by their consensus recommendations, and then there's a parenthetical further clarifying that. And it would hereby amended to read, the working group shall take into account any criteria for IGO or INGO protection that may be appropriate, including any that may have been developed previously, such as the list of IGO and INGO identifiers that was used by the GNSO's prior PDP working group. And so basically it expands from the previous one, which is rather restrictive and opens up completely. Now, I had raised a question with the co-chair and staff whether this was the right approach about an earlier version of this, in that it still mentions INGOs, which we are no longer, we've considered and dropped, although this is a charter for our entire work, and they would be encompassed in being considered and dropped, and that it has no specific reference to Article 6 tier of the Paris Convention, which is what we've really determined is the relevant group of IGOs that we're going to target for whatever we recommend, which is those that have exercised their rights. Staff response was that they understood all that, but the aim here was to replace the narrow mission and scope statement in the original charter with a much more flexible one that we could do whatever we wanted with in terms of our end product. So I'm going to stop there and open the discussion for any comments on whether folks in this working group think the new proposed mission and scope statement gets what we want to do. And again, the aim of this is to get away from being locked into the list used by the earlier working group, which included IGOs that we think are within our scope of work and IGOs that we think are not. I hope that wasn't confusing.
Thanks, and before I turn over to Caddy, I just noted that in point five, where it's referred to the December 2011 open letter that was signed by 28 IGOs. It was interesting to see that in that letter they specifically said that the names and acronyms of IGOs are protected within the scope of Article 60 of the Paris Convention for the Protection of Industrial Property, as further referred to in Article 16 of the Trademark Law Treaty and Article 2 of the WTO agreement. They're also talking specifically about Article 6 term. Okay, Caddy, the floor is yours.
Hi, thank you. Do we want to include any language of description here? Because I know that the groups that put in the limitations will have questions about why we're expanding now. And I also wanted to check, because I know I've missed some meetings from time to time, have we talked about, and again, I apologize if I missed it, what's on our list of IGOs? I know we're talking about the Sixter. I guess the question is in general, what's the difference as we're looking at the IGO names from the first paragraph, the existing paragraph, to the new paragraph? What's the difference, and how would we explain this to people who liked the limitations and may fear that we're taking them off? Thank you.
Thanks, Caddy. I'll leave it over to Mary.
Thanks, Petter, and thanks for the questions, Kathy. So in terms of the specific question about the difference, if I'm interpreting your question correctly, sorry if I misheard, the original mission and scope that you see that we reproduce in this draft motion limits this group to basically what's on the DAX list. And as we discussed, and I think especially in the Singapore meeting, that's different from the six-tier list, and it was felt that in some ways that's actually a lot broader and more vague. So by expanding the charter, the hope is that will allow this group to take into account other criteria and other lists, as we seem to have already done. The other point is that in terms of how the language works here now, as Phil mentioned, we had considered making a specific reference to 6TER, for example, but given that the problem we encountered with our original charter is limiting language, it was felt that it might be more useful to actually have more flexible language. And so this doesn't limit the working group in its consideration. It certainly doesn't limit us in terms of our ultimate recommendation. And the final thing that I would say on this point is that obviously much of our recommendations, to the extent we have any at this point, are preliminary. So we do still have to go back, do a consensus call, et cetera, and that's why, again, it was felt that having more flexibility and generality in the amendment might be preferable. I hope that answers your question.
May I respond?
Yes, please.
Would it be appropriate to put something about Sixter into the whereas clauses? So we're providing some guidance to people about what we're thinking.
Kathy, I think it is there in the some of the whereas clauses. I'm just going back up. And yes, I think it is clauses 4 and 5.
Right. Okay.
And again, we wanted to be careful to not circumscribe the working group because,
no, you're
unlikely.
Exactly right. That's it.
Yeah, it's
Thank
possible
you.
That we might go back and say, well, maybe this isn't the right thing after all. So hopefully that's helpful.
Gary, thank you.
Thanks. Petter, yes, it is mentioned in the beginning of the document, and in fact, what we mean in practice within a working group when we say extend to other criteria is to limit it to 6TER. But I guess that we cannot specifically write that when we ask for amendments, rather than to have a text that gives us the freedom to make that proposal. Okay, George.
George Griglis speaking. I noticed that the proposed amended version still mentions the INGOs. I was under the impression that we've already decided not to make any changes with regards to INGOs. So perhaps in the first sentence, the or INGO, and then the later in that sentence, and INGO identifiers can be removed, because I think it would be kind of confusing for people to think that the INGOs are back on the table when we've decided to not consider any changes with regards to them.
Well, Peter, I think this is more a solve to our initial task, and we haven't really yet got the official limitation to IGOs. So I presume that's why we still need to refer to both IGOs and INGOs. Am I right, Mary?
Yes, Peter. I think it goes back to the flexibility question again. And so obviously, it will not circumscribe the working group, and we can, in our final recommendations, basically say we were asked to look at this whole universe, and we determined that actually it's this portion of the universe that's the most appropriate. So hopefully having the flexibility allows us to do that, and also allows for the possibility that as we go back to look at our preliminary conclusions, we can have a comprehensive consensus call as well. Thanks.
Thanks. Phil?
Yeah, to add to that, George, that's a good question. I had those thoughts originally, but you got to think of this as going back to the beginning. If we're basically time traveling back to when the council adopted this resolution and kind of pretending that this is what it was from the beginning, it doesn't prevent us from deciding, as we've already decided, that INGOs need no special protection, and the presence of INGOs in the resolution simply provides a base for us to explain that we considered them and decided they didn't need it. Similarly, the new language that allows us to take into account any criteria that may be appropriate gives us a broader base for saying, well, we looked at Article 6 tier, we looked at the UN list and all of that, and decided that the only appropriate criteria was exercise of protective rights under the Article 6 tier of the Paris Convention, that the other things didn't give rise to legal rights that should be recognized for purposes of any arbitration process to protect an IGO. So that's the way I'm thinking of it now.
Okay, thanks. Any other comments? Well, did you add? Yeah. So, can we agree that this document is something that can be sent to the council? You'll be up on the next meeting. We have, as we said, until Monday to decide on that. Kerry.
Sorry, no, it's just a check mark to say I agree.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, good. Well, good. Then I presume that we can go further to point number 4 on the list to discuss consideration issues relating to possible de novo appeal mechanism for IGOs. And I've thank the staff for a very interesting briefing note with the historical background. There, for instance, if you see from the 2003 Secretariat paper that recommended some minimum elements for such a procedure, that the parties should be able to restate their case completely anew. They should not be confined to claiming that the UDRP panel did not consider certain relevant facts or wrongly applied the UDRP, but should also be able to submit new evidence and new factual legal arguments. And in order to provide a meaningful appeal, conducting a de novo arbitration should, as a general rule, not be more burdensome than conducting litigation in a court of mutual jurisdiction. Three, the arbitral tribunal should consist of one or more neutral and independent decision makers who should not be identical or related to the panelists who render the UDRP decision. And finally, number four, either party should be able to present its case in a complete manner. The arbitral tribunal should, for example, have the authority to allow for or request additional written submissions, and it should be possible to hold in-person hearings, which is still possible when it comes to some other online disputes, but very rarely done. I also, what I think was interesting was this, the when the SCT discussed the paper, looking at the reservations from some countries, that the reservations were more of practical issues relating to, well, to summarize, is there a need actually for this? Canada talked about the cost and burden of such process, and Australia adopted the needs, since certain countries had already filed UDRP complaints. U.S. and Japan had other discussions more related to that an arbitral appeal mechanism would contribute to eliminating the four most important due process safeguards of the UDRP. Again, a reference to the consistent UDRP. And then a note coming from Sweden that Denmark, New Zealand, Switzerland, and Sweden supported such an appeal mechanism. Whether the Netherlands was not convinced that it was necessary. So my generally summary of this is that the arguments against it was not so so strong and clear, more of a practical way, and those that did not support it more questioned whether it was necessary. But I leave the floor open to discuss this. George,
Petter,
please.
Jim Bykoff.
Jim, okay, please.
I just apologize for being late. I was on another call, so I missed a lot of the other comments earlier. But it seems to me on this appeal procedure, we have the same question as was raised in the past, which is it necessary? Not even getting into the question of who pays and how much it's going to cost, but you know, it seems that we're sort of putting the cart before the horse here, because we haven't heard anything yet from, I assume we haven't heard anything yet from you know, in response to the questions from either GAC or the small group of IGOs, and you know, should we be putting effort in on something that may prove to be completely unnecessary, or should we concentrate on getting responses to the questions we have, which I think you've discussed while I was not on the call, and then proceed with a course of action based on those responses?
Thanks, Peter. Yeah, as you're perfectly right, we will try to reach out and remind about both from both groups that we need responses to our questions, and especially from IGOs, as you have seen, we have specified our questions in order to hopefully get more also clear and specified replies. So there you're perfectly right. Although I think it was interesting to see the work that has been done and take an initial general discussion about this. George?
Hello?
Yes.
George,
please. The floor is yours.
Sorry, I was muted. Yeah, I would agree with the comments by Jim Bykoff. And also to go further, I'd be opposed to this procedure for additional reasons. If you look at the actual appeal mechanism they're suggesting, they would have basically one, quote, meaningful appeal, you know, which is de novo as an arbitration. But that doesn't really mirror what happens in the real courts. For example, in my province of Ontario, I'm located in near Toronto, the first court of instance would be the Ontario court, and then there would be the Ontario, which is the provincial court, and then the next level of court would be the Court of Appeals, and then the final appeal mechanism would be the Supreme Court of Canada. So there's three levels that are possible in terms of, you know, a dispute beyond the UDRP. They're proposing to replace that with one final arbitration, which doesn't really, and that arbitration is the first is equivalent to maybe the lowest level of the Ontario Ontario court. And I would assume that in the United States they'd have similar procedures. They'd have presumably federal court as the first court of a dispute, and then the Federal Court of Appeal, and then the Supreme Court if it gets that far. So the due process compared to the real courts is a lot less in this procedure, and so that's something I'd be very concerned about. And also, they don't necessarily say what the remedies would be. Like, it still seems to be the only remedies would be taking away the domain name or canceling the registration, which is very different from what a court can do. A court can, you know, award monetary damages. A court can say, you know, stop doing this, you know, change the use of the domain name to not be infringing, which is something that seems to be very different than what this arbitration procedure is limited to.
Thanks. Mary?
Thanks, Peter, and thanks, George and Jim. So just a couple of not so much responses, but follow-ups, I suppose. One is that the idea of presenting this document was, as Peter said, to take note of some of the historical work that's been done. And so from the chairs and staff's perspective, it's more of an FYI at this point, to which we may return depending on the nature of the responses that we may get from the GAC and the IGOs. On George's point, in fact, George, I think if you've looked at the papers, you probably have, some of these issues were acknowledged, and there is some discussion about, for example, what the actual burdens might be, what the ability of the appeals arbitrators would be to not just go back de novo into the whole case, but the sort of awards they can make. On the one hand, this is difficult because most arbitral mechanisms conventionally have dealt with different types of issues and remedies. So there's this big question in the international law world about, you know, enforcement of arbitral awards in different jurisdictions, which fortunately or otherwise in our case of the UDRP doesn't arise, but that in and of itself does create problems, you know, because of the fit for example. So a lot of these issues in terms of whether the procedure and the rules and the burdens and so forth would match to the UDRP and in an arbitration versus the court, those are discussed in the paper. So I would encourage working group members to look at the full paper, which is on the working group wiki if you're interested. And as I noted, Petter, I think we will come back to at least some of this after we get the IGO and GATT responses. Thanks.
Thanks. Phil?
Yeah, Phil, for the record, responding further, first, Jim, yeah, I'm with you that, you know, but we're not putting the cart before the horse here. We understand that we need to get responses, that we need to understand the sovereign immunity issue a lot better before we even think about some appeals process other than the one that's in the UDRP now, which is access to national courts. We merely... the co-chairs working with staff, while we're waiting for that other information, we wanted to, even though we have a less frequent meetings right now, while we wait for it, we wanted to have a full meeting and thought it would be useful to get this historical background. Turning to the substance of what staff has in this paper, I find it, you know, and it's I am a resident of the U.S., so I pay particular attention to U.S. Views, and especially given the fact that ICANN is not an agency of the U.S., but is in a U.S. jurisdiction, and all its contracts are under U.S., you know, interpreted under U.S. law. I found it interesting that the U.S. Said that an arbitral appeal mechanism would eliminate the four most important due process safeguards of the UDRP. That was a 2003 opinion. My recollection is that just the year before, the State Department had sent that telegram to the U.S. UN office in New York saying, tell any IGOs who asked it if they think they have a trademark complaint in the U.S., their remedy is to file a Lanham Act suit. So I think we need to, again, check with Suzanne Riddell to make sure this is still the U.S. view. But what concerns me the most here, and where I think I have a real question, is that is this sentence that's underlined above notes where it says, once he, she does sue, then final determination of the case will be resolved through the appeal procedure and the possibility of challenge in a national court will then be precluded. If that was a statement in the paper, I have to really question whether that statement is accurate. And let me give you an example. Let's say, and I think it's highly doubtful, but let's say we decided that the scope of sovereign immunity for IGOs is so broad and pervasive that we need to create a arbitration system appeals mechanism rather than a national court appeal, which is there now. And we amend the UDRP or create a new CRP that does that. And we'd further, I think, you know, to tie things up legally, registrants registering or renewing their domains would have to be made aware of that if an IGO brought a complaint. They might not have the usual remedies. I don't know how that would be done. I don't know how it would be done for registrations, you know, say for 10 years that were done several years ago. But as a practical matter, I don't think that would work. I'll give you an example. Let's say that I registered the domain worldhealth.something, one of the new TLDs. I pick out one that I think is appropriate. Maybe it's worldhealth.tech, and I'm writing about technology developments. I'm using it as a website to discuss technology developments which impact world health and improve world health. And the World Health Organization decides that that domain name is confusingly similar and bring an arbitration action against them. It's a well-known principle that you can't waive your legal rights by contract, at least in the U.S. So even if I've signed a registration agreement where I've waived my access to the courts, if an IGO, you know, brings an arbitration against me, I'm not sure that would stop me if I lose that arbitration, if the arbitration panel decides that the World Health Organization should get worldhealth.tech, that it should be transferred to them. I'm going straight to court and seeking an injunction to stop that. And I don't believe any court would agree that I had waived my legal rights to do so. So I'm basically raising the question of whether anything we do can really stop a private party from access to national courts if they don't like a procedure which says that they've rescinded that ability and only have access to an arbitration panel as an appeal. So I think if we ever go down this road, I think we have to consider that question very carefully. And I see Mary's putting some in the chat room, which I'm going to stop talking now and read what she just put up. Thank you.
Thanks. And I also see Mary's hands up. I leave it to you, Mary, to say what you have written.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you, Phil. So this is really just for the record for folks who may not be in Adobe chat, but essentially going back to Phil's point about precluding the challenge in a national court, the language in the briefing note is actually the interpretation by staff of the wording in the WIPO Secretariat paper. So what I've done is put the Secretariat's language in the chat room for everyone to read, and some of the issues raised by Phil would clearly have to be things that we may need to talk further about down the road. It may also be that some of the points in this paper will allow for points of engagement with the GAC, for example, between now and Buenos Aires or at some appropriate time. Thanks.
Thanks, Mario. Yeah, well, I also wanted to note that this was actually written and discussed and decided on, well, it's 12 years after now, so there has been a lot of domain disputes involving IGOs since then, and obviously we have seen that the system has worked fairly good in practice during these years. But again, it's interesting always to go back and see the initial discussion and decisions about certain topics. Anyone else that would like to make comments on this? Yes, Mary.
Thanks, Peter. Hi, it's Mary again, everybody. Sorry, I did mean to make an additional point in follow-up to Phil, and that is the notice to the registrant or the respondent, because the tenor or the theme in the Secretariat paper, insofar as we understand it, is that the basis for arbitration, generally speaking, is agreement. So in most commercial cases, for example, you arbitrate because there's an agreement, an arbitration clause, or an arbitration agreement. So it does seem that the Secretariat has contemplated that there would need perhaps to be a change to the registration agreement. And obviously they did not expound on this, and this is the staff interpretation, but that clearly would be another issue. Thanks.
Thanks, Mary. We'll send out the follow-up questions we discussed before to the IGO small group, and this topic is also included there. So it's good to know what have been discussed before, and good to have it on our table when we also receive replies to our questions. And that makes me slowly proceed to the final point, the next steps. We have decided today to send out these follow-up questions to the IGOs, and we have agreed about the draft motion that in such case will be up on the table at the council meeting on April 16. That comes to the question on when we shall have our next working group meeting. It seems that we, personally, at least, is that we will send out some documents now and collecting some more information. I'm not sure if we have enough to have a full agenda for the next week. Maybe it's more practical to skip the working group meeting next week and to have it, when would that be? April 15. Unfortunately, the day before the council meeting, but at least there's gone some more days where we hopefully can get some inputs from the IGOs maybe also from GEC that will be reminded about our need for inputs. So I open the floor for that.
Petter, Jim Bykov,
yeah.
My suggestion is, unless something happens that is really critical for us to discuss next week, that we skip next week and go to the week after.
Good. I see no hands up, so let's decide on that. And, of course, if there anything comes up in between, we'll also send out to the full list. Phil?
Yeah, I wanted to, Phil here, I wanted to second Jim's suggestion. There's no sense meeting every week if we don't have some substantial substance to discuss. I did want to mention that a few weeks ago I went through our original kind of checklist of things we were going to explore, our work plan. There were a couple of secondary items that hadn't been fully addressed, so that might be something we can revisit and check those items off in either the meeting in 2 weeks or certainly within the near terms, just to be comprehensive. But our big impediment now to making a final push toward a report is feedback from the IGOs and the GAC and better understanding of the parameters of sovereign immunity for IGOs. So until we have that data, I think we have to kind of tread water for a while.
Thanks. Good. Then we'll see each other, so to speak, within 2 weeks from now. And in the meantime, Bill and the staff tonight will see what's coming up and discuss if there are any specific questions and items, so we can have a good meeting in what will be April 15, if I'm not read it wrongly. So, thanks for today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Richard. You may now stop the recording.
Bye, all.
Bye.
Bye, everybody. Thank you.